So, we're in the series of hot topics, and the hot topic I've been given is grappling with creation in an age of evolution. Thanks. Yeah. So, I'm not a scientist. I know that makes me sound like a woman in a dental advert, but I'm not a scientist, but I know where to look. So I've been given this hot topic, grappling with creation in an age of evolution, or to give it an alternative title, why aren't there any dinosaurs in the Bible? Genesis 1. It goes like this. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness covered the face of the waters, while the Spirit of God swept over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God looked upon the light and saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there it was, evening and morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." So God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the water that was above the dome. And it was so, and God called the dome sky. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seeds, and fruit trees of every kind, that bear fruit with the seed upon it." And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed of every kind, and trees of every kind, bearing fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good, and there it was, evening and morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky, to separate the day from the night, and let there be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the great light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there it was, evening and morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky." And so God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves of every kind, with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, and saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." And there it was, evening and morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things, and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. And God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Let us make humankind in our own image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God he created them, male and female he created them. God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. God said, "See, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps upon the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good. And there it was, evening and morning, the sixth day. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So I will set my stall up early. I will say, what I want to suggest this morning is that creation and evolution are not two opposing arguments. That evolution, as scientists now understand it, is part of creation. Part of God's creation. And that we worship a creator God, a creative God. A God who creates and a God who gives things the ability to change and adapt and to grow. I'll give him a moment. Safe journey in all directions. Yeah. Don't forget your handbag. Or is that somebody else's? That's right. Yeah. So, once more with feeling. Creation and evolution are not two opposing arguments. Evolution, as scientists now understand it, is part of creation. It's all part of God's creation as we worship a creator God. And for this, I'm drawing quite heavily on the works of an American paleontologist called Stephen Jay Gould, who died in 2002. And he was, he described himself as a Jewish agnostic, whilst also freely acknowledging that there's no such thing. And he was the one who came up with a theory that some scientists, a lot of scientists agree with, some disagree, and I'll talk about them in a minute. But Stephen Jay Gould's big fat theory was what he called non-overlapping magisteria. Non meaning non. Overlapping, meaning overlapping. Magisteria, meaning teaching. Magister, from the Latin. So that science and religion are not competing. They're not in opposition to one each other. They are asking and answering different questions. Non-overlapping magisteria. So he separated himself there from the works of people like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, who were part of the New Atheist movement, who wanted to say that science had an opinion about everything and that science had a greater morality than religion. And Stephen Jay Gould was major among scientists to go, hang on a minute there, not entirely sure I agree with all your police work. It's bigger than that. It's more complicated than that. There's a lovely thing on the internet. It's a little flow chart. And it says in the box at the top, do I have to listen to Richard Dawkins? And the line goes two ways. And the next line is he talking about evolutionary biology? If yes, then yes, you have to listen to him. If no, then no, you don't. Stephen Jay Gould said that science and religion are asking and answering different questions. In 1997, he wrote an essay, which was partly an answer to Pope Pius's encyclical in 1950, Humani Generis. And he says this: science tries to document the factual character of the natural world and to develop theories that coordinate and explain these facts. Religion, on the other hand, operates in the equally important but utterly different realm of human purposes, meanings and values, subjects that the factual domain of science might illuminate but can never resolve. When I turn a light on, that's science. When I look up the internet on my phone, that's science. When I want to know the truth about who I am, that's religion. Separate questions. Separate questions, non-overlapping, not competing. And evolution is a part of that. Unmistakably, by any measure, by any set of facts you care to look at. So you look at Genesis 1, and you look at this highly detailed account of the first 6 days. And the obvious question is, was it 6 actual days? Was there a little man with a clipboard and a stopwatch standing next to God going, yeah, no, it's 23 hours and 17 minutes, you've not got long. Yeah. Of course there wasn't. God took his time because it was his time. God did what needed to be done, and it took as long as it took. In 2 Peter, never forget, we read this. 2 Peter chapter 3 verse 8. But do not ignore this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord one day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like one day. So if one day is but 1,000 years, or 1,000 years is but one day to the Lord, what about 10,000? What about 1,000,000? What about 1,000,000,000? What about several billion? Does it matter? Was anybody there to tell him no? God did what God had to do, and it took as long as it took, and God was in charge of it, and that's how it happened. Some of you will know of my admiration for an American stand-up comedian, the late Bill Hicks, who was very big in the 90s, and like most comedians who are very big in the 90s, he is spectacularly sweary. So if that's not your thing, don't seek him out. But Bill Hicks was the son of a Baptist minister. You can hear it in the cadences of his stand-up act, and you can hear it in some of the things he tackles. And being from the southern parts of America, that meant that kind of unquestioning fundamentalism that takes the whole of the Bible literally, even the bits that shouldn't be. And so Bill Hicks once asked one of these guys about dinosaur bones. See, I told you I'd get to it. You know, what were dinosaur bones there? And the bloke went, ah, well, dinosaur bones, they're a test. God put them there as a test. And Bill goes, really? Really? Because if he did, I don't believe in that kind of God. How old were these dinosaur bones? Several million. Ha! Wrong! You're in hell. You know, it's not like that. God created over years, over centuries, over millennia, and still does. And evolution is a natural part of that. What fascinates me, and I mentioned this to Danny the other day, what fascinates me is the very latest post-Darwinian theory about how the Earth came into being has things happening in the following order. Primordial ooze, crawling things, sea creatures, sea monsters, mammals, man. Where have we read that recently? The myth, the story that was put together in the time of Moses to help explain things and got them in the right order. Because God was there. God was at the heart of this. God is in this story. God is in the creation of the world. God is in the evolution of the world. God is in the way things change. One thing at a time, step by step. Most scientists these days, most physicists particularly, don't believe that evolution is a continuous flow, but a series of step changes as things adjust as things develop, as things accommodate themselves to the new normal. That's why, for example, anyone who says, why don't you find skeletons at the halfway stages, is asking completely the wrong question. Because things change and adapt, and the things that survive long enough breed with each other, and the dominant characteristics pass themselves on from generation unto generation. Consider, if you will, Darwin's finches. Charles Darwin explored the islands of Galapagos and made note of the facts that the finches on different islands had different beaks because they ate different things. And you look back from now and it's obvious that those finches that could get into the food lived long enough to breed, and the dominant characteristics passed themselves on from generation unto generation. Consider the pigeon. About 10, 12 years ago, I was in South Africa on a theatre conference, Stellenbosch, near Cape Town. And there were lots of fairly exotic bits of wildlife, the ibis with its great long beak and all of that. But there were also pigeons. They looked like pigeons, they strutted like pigeons, they ate like pigeons, they made cooing noises like pigeons. And they were brown and red. I did not see a green and grey pigeon the whole time I was there. Because in largely rural South Africa, a brown pigeon will live longer than a grey pigeon, and in London, it's quite the reverse. And so the dominant characteristics pass themselves on from generation unto generation unto generation. Consider the Dawes at Moorhead. The farm where my mother grew up was built, the farmhouse was built in 1683. All the doors are 5'8". Is it because the architect was an idiot, or they were short of wood? No. It's because people were smaller then. People are healthier now, they live longer, they're taller on average than they were 400 years ago. It's not, you know, it's an average. Yeah. There are people, and there are people. There were tall people then, and they all banged their heads. Yeah. Consider, if you will, the Buddleia. It's the Buddleia, you know. And you read about the Buddleia in a gardening thing. I did, I looked it up specially. And it grows best in a well-drained soil and direct sunlight. Which, of course, explains why it grows so well on building sites, railway lines, and halfway up a vacant shopfront in Winchester's High Street. Things change and adapt to the new normal. Things grow in different ways. Things adapt in order to survive. Things evolve. Evolution is part of creation. And we worship a creator God. God gave things the ability to change, to develop, to grow. And God put man at the heart of that. If you go back to Genesis 1 and to verse 28, there it is. There it is. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, tame it, domesticate it, breed it, take things in hand." Sheep now do not look like sheep 400 years ago. Cats and dogs and horses do not roam wild everywhere. Some places, obviously, they've gone a bit feral, but they are tamed. They are domesticated. They have evolved from what they were 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years ago. And man has been part of that, and God put him there. So I believe in a creator God. I believe that God gave things and people the ability to adapt and change, to evolve over the years, over the centuries, in order to survive and thrive. Which brings me to the church. The church has evolved over the centuries. You will notice, for example, that I am not speaking Latin right now. The church changes and develops to find the new normal and then to thrive in it. And it has always done this. And it has done this within our lifetimes. I was at Swathling a few months ago, and I preached, and a woman who'd been invited along came and said, you know, she was very touched and moved by my service. It was nice. And she was quite surprised by this, and that I wasn't wearing a white shirt and a tie. Now, you may think that's a bit odd of her to think that, but think back. How long since that was unthinkable that the minister would not be wearing a suit? Even in a non-conformist church, even in a church that prides itself on its rebellious nature, the minister and he, and it's a he, would be wearing a good suit and a tie.
It's less than 20 years.
Less than 20 years. That's less time than I first got membership at City Road. It is, because I was married to Trish for 21. That's at least 26. So, within our recent lifetimes, things have changed. Things have adapted. Things have evolved within the life of the church. And will continue to do so as we face challenges. This is where I want to talk about Spurgeon's. I've been talking with my friends on the course and a lot of the other training ministers. We are not alone in the challenges that we face. We are not even unique in the challenges that we face. A few weeks back, as part of the professional ministerial practice, Ken Benjamin, the president of the Baptist Union, came along and gave a talk not dissimilar to the one we attended in Andover. Where do we grow from here? The challenges that the church faces to speak to the people who don't turn up regularly. The challenges that the church faces to make itself sustainable in a way that it would never have even had to wonder about 20, 30, 50 years ago. The way that the church needs to talk to people in a language that they will understand. In exactly the same way that it has always done. The change from the formality of 50 years ago, the change from the Latin of 600, 700 years ago. Not that far when you think about it, not in the life of the church. And sometimes that involves changing back to the way things have been done before. You look at the church in the book of Acts, it's less formal, it's less structured, it's more gathered. And then as the church gained in authority and in secular power, it lost that because it needed the formality, it needed the hierarchy, it needed the structure in order to become part of the state machinery. And things changed, and things adapted, and things evolved. And the church came to realise that it had lost something by allying itself too close to the state. There are some countries where it still hasn't quite worked that out yet. America, cough, cough. Yeah. And so the church needs to change. The church needs to adapt. The church needs to grow and develop. The church needs to evolve. And God has given it that ability. Because He gives it to all of us. He gives us the ability to tame, to domesticate, to regroup, to rethink, to create, to evolve. So if we are not to go the way of the dinosaurs, not just looking over our shoulder for meteors, but also thinking about what we do every day. And we're seeing it. We're seeing seeds. We're seeing small new growth. And it's like the buddleia. It's growing in places that it was never intended to grow in the first place. And that's even true right here. So, we believe in a church that worships God. We believe in a church that allows His Spirit to work in us. We believe in a church that follows the teachings of Jesus Christ. We believe in a church that tries to walk His way. We believe in miracles. We believe in what we're told in the Bible about the things that Jesus did and the words that He preached and the stories that He told. And again, what I'm hearing at Spurgeon's is so many different expressions of this. We had a chap come and talk to us a few weeks ago who is head of the Baptist Church in Lithuania. And that's not very many people, but he was head of it. And he is also a trained actor. So he was talking about using performance in mission. This was so far up my street, I was surprised not to see my postcode on the PowerPoint. But and he uses church, you know, not in worship, but in mission. He uses performance in mission. He goes out to people and he works with them, creating drama that talks about their issues. And then brings God into that, as if He is not there already. So it's about creating communities and then bringing the church to those communities, rather than waiting for those communities to come into the church. And that's just one of the things, one of the people that I've heard from. And again, there's a thing on a Tuesday called a pastoral group. Your prayers for us are welcome. And it's basically, it's all the middle-aged postgrads. Don't tell them I said that. And so there's 12, 13 of us and one of the staff. And we tell each other what's going right, what's going wrong, and then we pray about it. And that is the most helpful thing. It is the most spiritual thing. It is hugely, hugely encouraging that we've got these little points of connection. And so there's this youth minister from Essex, and there's this church secretary from Marlow, and then there's me, and then there's others, and we are together. And then looking outwards at what we can do in our church and beyond to change the world, one step at a time. And God is in that.